KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's like Clint Eastwood did in The Line of Fire when he ran next to the president's limo to protect him, and he all of a sudden ran out of breath, kind of like, I think I'm too old for this.
That's the essence of airline design, is all this sequential what-if questions. What if this goes wrong? What if the next thing goes wrong? What if all these things go wrong?
And to paraphrase a very, very dear friend, we are the Ontario Liberal Party, the best province. Best... Oh, and that was the big line. Okay, I'm just going to do it again.
Oh, you have that big line, and look what happens. A little bit of politics from Canada that's coming up this hour. Also looking at Boeing and the impact of the grounding of the Dreamliners. And that was the Gubernator talking about his new movie. We'll talk about that with Robert Horton. Vaughn Palmer is our guest. He's the political correspondent with Vancouver Sun. Hello, Vaughn.
Hello, Steve.
Didn't you used to cover film sometime back when the Gubernator was first making movies?
Yeah. No, this is a movie critic way back in the 1970s, when movie cameras were still being cranked by hand, and there was a guy sitting in the corner of the theater playing a piano for the music. Not quite that far back, but a long time ago.
Well, there haven't been any Canadian stars that have gone into politics, have there? Like along the lines of Arnold?
No. Our stars tend to go to the United States and become stars. There's lots of comedians and great Canadian actors. And
then they should come back and run for office.
Debatable figures like James Cameron wandering around the movie landscape in the United States, generating controversy and making movies.
Cameron would be, he could run for something.
Yeah, I guess he could.
All right, Vaughn, you were thinking about women in combat and the lessons Canada has to offer because Canadian women have been in combat.
Yeah, let me give you a little story. Nicola Goddard, she's in high school in Prince Edward Island in Canada many years ago now. And the military recruiter comes to the high school and says he wants young men to go into the military and go into combat. And she tells her dad that she thinks it's wrong that just men go into Canadian military and go into combat. She thinks women are allowed to join the Canadian military. They should get a combat role. She does. She goes into the Canadian military. She becomes a captain. She becomes an artillery officer. And on May 17th, 2006, while part of the Canadian contingent in Afghanistan, she's in a light armored vehicle that's hit by two rocket-propelled grenades. She becomes the first female member of the Canadian military to die in combat. So that's the story. We do have women in combat. They've been allowed in combat roles in the Canadian military for many years. And, of course, the poignant part of that is you also get killed. We've had three women killed in combat in Afghanistan in combat roles, members of the Canadian military. We've had some 300 Canadian women serve in combat roles in Afghanistan. We've had the first senior officer to command a military brigade of infantry in Afghanistan. So we've been there. You have to remember the sad side of the story when you think about also it being a breakthrough for women.
Any controversy over women being in combat in Canada?
The only lingering controversy over it, when Captain Goddard was killed, I think a lot of people in the country stopped to think, and understandably so. But the only real controversy, and the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times both had stories last week on Canada's experience, and they both noted that some of the women who've served in the Canadian forces overseas in Afghanistan came away thinking that they still were being slighted on some of the military missions. The Canadian forces say that's not the case, that it's the commander's decision and it's depending on contingencies, and there's lots of Canadian women who've been in the line of fire, but there is a little bit of controversy around that. But no, I mean, the country has accepted that with serving in the military comes service in combat and comes the terrible risk of being maimed or killed.
And then it becomes a story, a regular story. Vaughn Palmer is our political correspondent with Vancouver Sun, our guest. Talk about news from Canada on weekday. Well, so here's another story. New Premier of Ontario, Catherine Wynne, a woman. She's also openly gay. Does anybody care about these tallies anymore besides the reporters?
I think the number of women serving as Premier in Canada has become a bit of a story. Les Lane, who you use regularly on the show when I'm on holiday.
We do use him, too, by the way.
Yeah. Les had a very funny piece last week about our endangered male premiers in Canada, that the government needs to think about protecting them because they're the way the trend's going, there won't be any men running Canadian provinces. There are five of the 10 Canadian premiers, so we have 10 provinces, are women, and one of our territorial leaders as well. So there are six people in the country holding the title of premier who are women, and this has been growing. This trend is a trend. Ontario and Quebec, our two largest provinces, both have women as premiers. Alberta and British Columbia, our third and fourth largest provinces, have women as premiers. And there's another province that has a woman premier, and Newfoundland and one of our territories. So circumstantial, I guess. A lot more women getting involved in politics, and when these provinces have a premier step down who's a man, and the best candidate to succeed him is a woman, that tends to be happening. You've had leadership contests, and there have been women in all of them, and the women have been winning in a few of those provinces as well. Quebec, Alberta, and Newfoundland, you've had elections where those women have then gotten elected. So their party has picked them as leader, and they've become premier, and then they have an election. Now, here in British Columbia, Premier Christy Clark is in trouble in the opinion polls. She's got an election in May. We'll see if she wins. In Ontario, the new premier there, Catherine Wynne, that province hasn't had an election yet, so she's been picked by her party, and she'll be premier, but she hasn't faced the election yet.
But I got to say, Vaughn, you sent along this information along with the story, and representation in the province's various parliaments still pretty low, one-third and less for women in some of these bodies. So still a little bit of progress to be made to get us up to even equality.
Yes. Some provinces, the parties are in charge of this themselves, the recruitment of candidates, and then the voters are in charge of whether or not they want to elect them. Some parties have had an affirmative action program of going out and trying to recruit more women into politics. The opposition party here in British Columbia, the New Democratic Party, has had a bit of a quota system. They've had a requirement that if a man retires in a safe seat, the party must pick a candidate from one of the groups designated for affirmative action, so a woman or a visible minority. So there's been some of that. Slow progress, but I actually think the real sign of progress is probably the change at the top, where you're getting, normally when a political party in Canada, between elections anyway, chooses a new leader, they will choose from people who've served in senior positions in government. And so as a result, as more and more women serve at the cabinet level as a minister of finance or health or education, something like that, the party has more candidates with a lot of experience to pick from. That's what happened in Ontario. You had Wynne was a senior minister in the government. That's what happened in Alberta. And I think you're starting to see more of that happen as the pool of people who've had experience in government grows. You're getting more and more women getting the top job.
Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent with the Vancouver Sun. Now, here's an interesting story with ramifications in America in terms of our immigration battle. HD Mining announced Monday it's sending home 16 Chinese miners it hired under a temporary foreign worker program for its Murray River coal mine. And this is a controversial worker program because unions are fighting against bringing in foreign miners. What does this say about Canada's relationship with the Chinese owners of this company?
This is a major, major controversy in British Columbia. You've got a Chinese company that has a mining property in British Columbia and that is looking to develop a coal mine. They sought to bring in a Chinese workforce because it was exploratory work at this point. They are not 100% sure they're going to go ahead with the mine. They've argued that the system of mining they were using, longline mining, there were not a lot of Canadians qualified and trained to do it, and therefore they got permission from the government under a temporary foreign workers program to bring in miners from China. That led to a real backlash in British Columbia and with some trade unions. The unions argued that the Chinese company had not really looked around to see if there were British Columbians qualified, that they had put a language requirement, one must speak Mandarin Chinese, that effectively acted as a barrier against hiring Canadians. And they went to court to force the company and the government to be more open about what happened here. The company has now, because of all the controversy, pulled the 16 Chinese miners that were here, taken them back to China. And there's some question as to whether or not this project will go ahead at all. So we're still in the state of flux where, you know, we're not 100% sure whether the backlash has killed the project or whether the company is simply going to come back and say, okay, well, we'll hire some qualified Canadians as well, and maybe we'll go ahead.
I mean, around the world, China operates that way, as of course do many multinational companies. So we shouldn't be surprised. Does it tell us anything about how the future might unfold with these resource-based companies around Canada?
Well, it tells you. I think the other aspect of this story worth commenting on is British Columbia has not kept up with anticipated demand for skilled labor in the province. We've not trained as many people in, highly skilled trade positions, mining, welders, shipbuilders, all those areas. The government is starting to do that. They're trying to get caught up, but you know, some of these positions, particularly the managerial ones and the overseer jobs, it takes a number of years to get really good at these methods. So the only training program, according to the government, the only training program in Canada for this kind of mining is in Ontario, and there weren't candidates available to fill the position. So there's a debate back and forth about whether or not we've done enough to make sure there are qualified Canadians for these resource companies that come here and want to do something. And the government says, well, why would we train an entire workforce for a mine that may never open? Like, what are we supposed to do with those people if the mine doesn't go ahead? So there's some back and forth on this. I think, you know, in general, I would say the government probably hasn't paid enough attention to the need to provide qualified Canadians for these positions. And the government also ran into a major public backlash because of the feeling that, you know, it's one thing to have foreign ownership of our resources and our mines, but another thing to think that Canadians aren't even going to get the jobs in them.
Well, there you are. That's sort of the rub we're going to run into down here as they start talking about immigration reform and new guest worker programs. It'll be interesting to see how that unfolds.
Yeah.
All right, sir. It was a pleasure talking to you once again.
As always, talk to you next week, Steve.
Take care, Vaughn. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent for the Vancouver Sun. He joins us every Wednesday on Weekday. A few more of these objects, these 25 objects that tell us about Seattle. It's going to be on our webpage, the list of all of them with pictures and little stories. And over at Weekday on KUOW, there's an entry there where you can put your recommendations for your own objects that reflect the history and the meaning of this region. We were looking at a statue that's called the Feminine One. It's in the Steinbrück family private collection and has been since the 1950s. And as we talked about, Victor Steinbrück worked with a small group of designers who were charged with coming up with the innovative design for the Space Needle. And our intern who came up with this project, Alexander Garrettin, talked with Victor Steinbrück's son, Peter Steinbrück, about how that sculpture, the Feminine One, inspired Victor Steinbrück's design for the Space Needle.
The original kernel of the idea was a napkin sketch drawn by Eddie Carlson, but the napkin sketch was more like a lollipop on a stick. And my father said that he drew something like 1,500 different sketches before eventually arriving at the form that drew the excitement and interest and then ultimately the final form of the Space Needle. When he developed the final concept, and this little sculpture, the feminine one, was on his in his office while he was drawing sketches over the weekend, undoubtedly, almost to the point of desperation, and at which point I think he probably had an aha moment. Feminine One is a small wooden sculpture carved from teak by an artist, David Lemon. The form of it is really described as three legs with a high waist that and flaring kind of arms reaching up to the sky. The final form of the Space Needle bears some resemblance to this little sculpture called the Feminine One. Acknowledging that there were other designers, I feel that it is part of our family's legacy that my father, Victor Steinbrück, was the primary source of inspiration for the Space Needle.
That's Peter Steinbrück talking about the my phone ringing. That'll be one of the objects that we'll talk about, why people leave their phones on. Peter Steinbrück talking about the Feminine One, one of the 25 objects that tell us about the history of our region. We're going to hear about one more, Kurt Cobain's cardigan. That's coming up a little later. This is Weekday.
The intersection of film and culture in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle section of the American Society of Civil Engineers, celebrating 100 years with a tribute to the civil engineers that built Seattle, now on display at SeaTac Airport at Gate B4. More information is online at seattleasce.org.
46 degrees in Seattle with clouds and light rain. Forecast says expect rain at times through the day with a high of 48. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:22. Some wicked storms have been wreaking havoc across the American South. High winds, rain, tornadoes, at least one person dead. We'll have more on that in 40 minutes.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
You know, Robert Horton, there's a controversy raging in the radio sphere about whether this is something that needs to be played all the way through,
yeah,
our theme, or whether it's too long. Raging controversy.
It's one of those fascinating controversies.
As you know me, I like to let the whole thing play because I like to get, did you bring the Milk Duds?
Yes, I did.
All right. See, that's why. It gives you time to get some Milk Duds. Robert Horton reviews films for us. He reviews films for the Herald and Everett, the people that actually pay him. He also has various engagements that he is involved in, including Mohai and the Magic Lantern series at the Fry Art Museum. And he's here to join us. Good to see you again.
Hi, Steve.
Excellent to talking to you again, as a matter of fact, because I was noting that one of my heroes, one of the heroes of the silver screen, back on the silver screen, the Gubernator.
Yes, yes. Not only Arnold Schwarzenegger, but Sylvester Stallone as well. A kind of convergence of 80s action movie stars, all happening in a very, very close proximity.
How are they doing, those old creaking folk?
Well, this is something that Hollywood is talking about quite a bit because I was reading a think piece in the Hollywood Reporter last night. And believe me, I've been waiting to say that sentence for years. About the fact that Schwarzenegger had his film open a couple of weekends ago. It's called The Last Stand. It is his first starring vehicle since leaving, obviously, to become the governor of the state of California. California, I should probably say. And it tanked. It did very, very poorly at the box office. It came in at number 10 out of 10 of the movies that, opened that weekend. And Stallone has a new film that's opening on Friday called Bullet to the Head, which is a fairly unequivocal title, I guess. And so I think it's one of those, it's just one of those turning the page sort of moments where people are saying, we may have passed from one thing to whatever the next thing is. We'll see how Bullet to the Head does, of course, but it's a moment.
Well, before I ask you about the movies,
yes,
the think piece in the Hollywood Reporter, was it wondering whether these particular actors have passed their moment or are clinging to something that they needn't cling to, or if that style of that genre of film has passed its moment? Because those would be two different things, right?
Yeah, I think so. And most of the
Jason Statham would disagree that they've passed their moment.
Yeah, although his movie that opened last weekend didn't do that well either.
Interesting.
So it is kind of interesting. There has never been the audience's appetite for violence has never really abated. This goes back to that fellow Bill Shakespeare, and probably has been consistent since then. But so we'll see. I mean, we'll see about that. But Schwarzenegger, in particular, has already shot a couple of other films, and you know, is
I mean, these are in the can.
Yeah, and is working on other things, and so there's a great deal of talk about whether or not he is still a person who can open a movie. Does anybody know who this guy is anymore? Can he actually make the kinds of movies that he was making in the 80s and be remotely credible and so on? So it's a little bit of a little flurry of anxiety.
Well, I've seen a few ads in the trailer for the Stallone movie, and the joke is that he's an old guy.
Yeah.
I'm getting too old for this.
Yeah, they always load that into these things, and there are jokes like that in The Last Stand with Schwarzenegger for sure. And yeah, well, they're trying to fend off that criticism and be self. These things are so self-conscious anyway.
Yeah,
the iconography. They're very aware of the iconography of the actors in question, and they play with that.
Well, what was wrong with The Last Stand?
You know, The Last Stand is actually not terrible. It's I can see why. I think there are a number of reasons audiences didn't come, but it's a standard sort of action movie. It's a Western dressed up in modern clothes. Schwarzenegger plays the sheriff of a small town in Arizona, and a guy is heading for the Mexican border, having broken out of prison. He's a big Mexican cartel kingpin or something like that. Has a Camaro that goes 200 miles an hour.
That's cool.
Did I mention that? No. Yeah. Of course, Schwarzenegger is the last hope.
I see. He's the last stand.
Yeah.
Why? What were some of the reasons audiences may not have gone?
Just, I think, the age of its star and the fact that he's been gone. And there's certainly some speculation of not only is he considered to be kind of a flop as a governor, but he had a personal scandal that broke about a year ago in which some very ungallant behavior of his came to light. And we have spoken often about how the off-screen stuff kind of bleeds over into an audience's perception of a movie star. And I don't know if that was entirely it, because people have gotten over that kind of thing before, but it's probably a combination of all those things. And you know what? Stallone's career was in eclipse during the aughts, and he very shrewdly dusted off Rambo and Rocky. And he did those movies back-to-back. He got the old war horses out, and he made new versions of them with plenty of references to the age of the protagonist in both films, and audiences remembered that. They wanted to see it. They turned out, and they kind of revived his career, at least for a while.
I pride myself on my knowledge of the pop culture.
Yes.
I missed that. He put out a new Rambo and a new Rocky, Rocky 112.
Yeah. And,
he didn't box in it, did he?
He did. He did. He got back in the ring. He continues to be a specimen, of medical wonder at the age of the mid-60s, whatever he is.
So the plot of the movie was the old guy gets back in the ring for the senior welterweight heavyweight champion? What?
I've blanked out some of it, Steve. But yeah, it was an acknowledgement that he, for some reason, had to go back in the ring. Much was riding on it. And Stallone's movies are full of masochism that gets rained down on him. He takes all kinds of punishment in his movies, and that was one of them. Rambo was ultra violent, and took him through the usual paces, and audiences knew those characters, and they wanted to see him again.
Right. So the other thing Stallone did, though, was he did Copland. He did movies where he was a little bit a different character. How about this one?
Rhinestone.
Yeah. Rhinestone. That was the one with Dolly Parton.
Right? Yes.
No, I was speaking of that one. That was back in his heyday.
Both of these guys did comedies.
Yeah.
It didn't work out that well for Stallone, but Schwarzenegger was very shrewd about, you know, teaming up with funny people. And they are, for a long time in the 80s and in the early 90s, they were shrewd managers of their careers, that's for sure. That's one of the things that's surprising about Schwarzenegger's flop with this movie is some of the pieces were there, funny character actors in the supporting cast, importing an interesting Korean director, action director, to be at the helm of it, although the movie isn't very distinguished, actually, as it turns out, in its action sequences. But maybe the subject wasn't going to connect with
it. Well, so how about Bullet in the Head? Is it Stallone reviving old characters, or is he revising his himself for this new age?
Well, he certainly revised his face and his body sometime over the way, but no, it's more of a standard action picture. In this case, importing a director who is actually a very good director, Walter Hill, who had some hits in the 80s himself, 48 Hours, for instance, terrific movie, and he made a movie with Schwarzenegger as well. And it just, for whatever reason, everything about it seems exhausted, really tired. Stallone doesn't look good, and he seems half-hearted, even with the, you know, action movie punchlines that are supposed to punctuate the end of a scene. There's an attempted 80s style buddy movie rapport between Stallone and his partner in this one, and that falls flat. That just doesn't seem to click at all. So it has a weird feeling of, you know, it's like the ghost of something. It's like the skeleton of something, but nothing's left, you know.
Yeah.
It's 30 years old now, and it's kind of, it's vanishing.
A theme is emerging here. Isn't there? There's a new Die Hard movie coming out, right?
Yes, there
a
is.
Good Day to Die Hard.
Yes.
Die Hard 905.
Fifth one?
Fifth,
yeah.
Die Hard.
Fifth one, yeah.
Bruce Willis.
Right.
It's the same vintage as these guys.
Pretty much a man who came to prominence during the 80s. Yeah.
Have you haven't seen that yet?
I haven't seen that yet, but that is also close in proximity with these others. It's a couple of weeks away. So it is almost a it's interesting because it's coming along almost as, well, here's a reassertion of a certain kind of 1980s action film, complete with the stars that you remember from that time. And we are in the midst of finding out whether that actually really does play anymore. And the flop of The Last Stand and just seeing how poor this Stallone movie is, Bullet to the Head, is, to me, it made me form the idea that somehow the 1980s are over, that they are actually over now. People have talked about them. You know, other movies allude to the 1980s all the time.
I had
pop culture.
Over.
It's very big.
They're over.
I hope they're over.
So isn't there, now here's this other thing. Isn't there one more movie? This is with Al Pacino and Alan Arkin.
Christopher Walken.
And Christopher Walken. Stand-up guys.
Stand-up guys, yeah. That's opening on Friday.
More aging stars trying to, but in this case, it doesn't seem like they're trying to revive sort of older careers. They're just playing the idea that they're old guys.
Yeah. They're not trying to tap this particular vibe. But you wonder what happens in a culture when we start to think about, when we start to put things in place in a different way, thinking about the past, thinking about those kind of mythologies that have upheld us for a while. And I couldn't help because, you know, that's what you pay me to do here.
That is what we pay you to do.
Or
think
whatever
about,
it is you
think
do.
About context, yes.
Is that I've also picked up some of the vibe recently of kind of a readjustment in that other great figure from the 80s who is enshrined in that mythology, which is Ronald Reagan.
Really?
Who's someone who's, of course, constantly mentioned by both sides of our political spectrum, and who is...
I have heard some people say he was the greatest president ever.
Many people have said that. If you watch Fox News for 15 minutes, someone will say that. But lately, even just the sense that we've heard in the last year of people repeating the observation that, you know, if Reagan were around now, he wouldn't be a Republican. And this is being said by people not just from the left, but also observers from the right of observing what was going on with the conservative movement in this country. And I wonder if that readjustment in the realities of thinking about Ronald Reagan might be something that is also changing. It's another reassessment of the 80s.
It wasn't a great decade for movies, was it?
Oh, I don't think so.
Yeah.
As you know, I have a website that's devoted to 80s movies reviews.
And not many of them are glowing.
I'm galumphing through that decade and by looking back, and it is maybe my least favorite decade for cinema, yeah. Hollywood was really mixed up and didn't know what it was doing, and I think got a lot better in the 90s, if only because there was a strong independent movement that came along and kind of revitalized certain things and so on. But culturally, I have my issues with the 1980s.
Great decade for music, though. Ronald Reagan, let that one go. Ronald Reagan's movie career being reassessed along with his political career by anybody?
Oh, I don't think so.
No,
just the thought of, these movies, these action films came along on a wave that followed a period of disillusionment, and they were asserting this kind of we're number one, shoot first, ask questions later kind of attitude that caught the wave, and they were unbelievably popular, and they were full of a kind of swagger that touched the nerve. And I'm not convinced that that is going to work in 2013.
Let's see how Clint Eastwood movies from the 80s fit into that.
Yeah,
that changed paradigm. How they'll be viewed in retrospect.
I mean, Eastwood. I think Eastwood's made some of those movies, but he also made some other really interesting movies. So his
in the 80s?
Yeah. He was directing films that were, you know, kind of offbeat and personal.
Bird, Pink Cadillacs, stuff like that.
Honky Tonk Man was back then, and Tightrope.
I see.
He was always working something interesting. I don't think he's going to suffer in this reassessment that I've just declared is happening.
All right. And
I'm not sure anybody else believes that.
You have declared it. So are you doing things? Stuff and things?
I'm always doing stuff and things. And tonight I'm going to be speaking on the subject of the Celluloid Seattle exhibit, which I was proud to be a curator for the Museum of History and Industry. The Seattle Office of Film and Music is having its monthly happy hour this evening at Spitfire in Belltown. It goes from 5 to 7, and around 6:30 or so I'm going to speak to the idea of Seattle as a place imagined by the movies.
Yeah.
So I'll talk for a little while, and people will be drinking, and I hope I don't interrupt anybody's drinking, including
please,
my own.
Please don't.
And Monday night, I'm going to be, I know you're excited about this, I'm going to be live tweeting. And
I don't understand. Are you always live tweet? I mean, when you're tweeting, you're live.
Well, that's one of the things I've been curious about, dead tweeting. I don't know how that works or who's doing it.
But what are you live tweeting about?
I will be live tweeting about the Celluloid Seattle exhibition. And Mohai will open up its channels. I don't know all the lingo for the tweets. And people I'll be sitting at my computer in any case, and people can ask questions.
In your bathrobe.
I will answer and we'll all have a fantastic
time. Oh, I see. You're going to do a live chat through tweet about Celluloid Seattle.
If that's what you call it.
That sounds a little bit more reasonable.
Well, I think live tweeting is a legitimate term. I'm going to be live tweeting in a mutual sense. There's going to be mutual tweeting going on.
You know, there's an image I don't even want to contemplate.
I hope you log in or call up or tweet.
Mutual live tweeting. Robert Horton.
At Citizen Horton, I should mention, is my
handle. Very good. At Citizen Horton.
Yes.
We shall look for you live tweeting in your bathrobe. Robert Horton reviews films for the Herald and Everett and for us weekday at KUOW. And speaking of Mohai and its wonderfulness and the objects that are there that help kind of encapsulate our history, we did this 25 objects that tell us about Seattle, Seattle and 25 Objects. By we, I mean Alexander Garrett and Jason Pagano. But I get to, you know, the royal we. Mm-hmm. So here's a story about a cardigan worn by Kurt Cobain of Nirvana. They like to dress like their audience dressed, of course. So here's a little bit of the tale of Kurt Cobain's cardigan.
We're looking at a cardigan, a 60s thrift store cardigan that Kurt Cobain wore quite often on their first Nevermind tour. And what I love about this cardigan is that you can see there's holes in the sleeves where he would stick his thumbs through. And it's very much that image of, you know, the height of grunge, that idea that these are guys that aren't wearing costumes. You know, they're wearing just regular clothes. And really, you know, they're wearing thrift store clothes because they were broke at the time. People really were into Nirvana and grunge in general because the band members looked like the audience. You know, it's you could relate to the people on the stage. They weren't these kind of rock icons or rock gods that were all about materialism and having fancy cars and getting laid and all that classic rock star stuff. I mean, Nirvana really spurred off that whole grunge movement, and grunge really became the biggest musical event that happened in the Northwest. So it really turned Seattle and the Northwest in general from being a sort of cultural backwater that nobody really paid attention to some place that people still pay attention to. That, you know, bands don't have to leave to go to New York or to LA to get signed anymore. Record companies come here and are interested in the talent that's here. And Nirvana really was the cause of that.
That was senior curator Jacob McMurray at the Experience Music Project. He took some time to talk with Alexander Garrettin about the legendary band and their influence on the city, on the music, and on our clothes. We are going to talk about the economy coming up. Stay with us.
KUOW Seattle. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:42.
On the next Fresh Air, William H. Macy. In the Showtime series Shameless, he plays an alcoholic father of six who each week stoops to new depths to scam and manipulate others.
We sit down, we read these scripts, and everybody's covering some part of his or her face going, "Oh my God, are you kidding?" Well, that's why it's called Shameless.
Join us.
William H. Macy, tonight at 8 on KUOW2. Discover KUOW's second program service at KUOW2.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the Kirkland Choral Society and Philharmonia Northwest, presenting Songs of Heaven, featuring chorale preludes by Bach and Respighi, Dvorak's Te Deum, and Chichester Psalms by Bernstein. Saturday, February 2nd, 7:30 p.m. at Meany Hall. Tickets at kirklandchoralsociety.org or Brown Paper Tickets.
46 degrees in Seattle with clouds and scattered rain. Forecast calls for rain at times through the rest of the day with a high of 48. Overnight, more rain, a low of 43. And tomorrow, Friday, partly sunny with a high of 50. Looks like it's going to be mostly sunny on Saturday with highs near 50. Now that the plans are out there, what's next for immigration reform? We'll take that up in 30 minutes.
Now, John Talton is here. Wednesdays are a fine day. Vaughn Palmer, Robert Horton, you come in.
The D is silent.
Wednesday?
D-J-O-N, Talton. The D is silent.
All right. Seattle Times economics columnist, I could say that. Blogs at roguecolumnist.com and is the author of 10 mystery and thriller novels, the new one coming out in late April or early May. Good to see you.
Thank you, sir.
James Sarecki. Sarecki wrote a column in the New Yorker, which you sent along, thinking about the 787 and what it meant for Boeing and what it means for Boeing. And I want to go to that meant for a minute, because he makes the point about, I think you've said this before too, that basically when Boeing merged with McDonnell Douglas, basically McDonnell Douglas bought Boeing with their money.
Exactly. And they brought in McDonnell Douglas management practices, which had done so good for them, And the engineering culture of Boeing was subsumed into the bean counterculture of McDonnell Douglas. And how's that working out for you?
Well, you're saying that that is in part why we have the 787 problems, not just the current problems, but the way the plane was built.
Exactly. It is too early to say, to paraphrase Zhou Enlai, when he was asked by Kissinger about how did the French Revolution work out, it is too early to tell what exactly is wrong with 787. But there's no question that the extreme outsourcing that was used, and in the case of the batteries, not giving precise instructions about what was to be built and how they were to be built, created enormous problems, all these delays with 787. And now we have this electronics problem that the company still has not been able to pin down. Every day that the plane stays grounded is a problem for Boeing and a problem for the airlines that have bought it.
Your colleague at the Times, Dominic Gates, had an article today. At least 100 batteries had failed in the 787 fleet. So Boeing has known about a problem for a bit.
It has, and it may be up to 150 batteries. These lithium-ion batteries, like you have in your computer, are very powerful, but they have been in the past prone to fires. When they were integrated as part of the 787, they had to get a special waiver from the FAA to do this. And we have to start wondering about regulatory capture here again, because what did the FAA really know about these batteries? Boeing says that it built in all these redundant systems to vent any fumes and to take care of any fire suppression problems. But these are very different from conventional batteries. Now, the advantage here is that the electrical system in the 787 does so much more than in a conventional airplane. It's one of the things that operates what, say, hydraulics would in a 777. It leaves so much weight out. The advantage of the 787 from the composite construction to the lithium-ion battery-driven electrical system is that it is a very lightweight airplane, and so it will save fuel in a higher-cost energy future. If they have to go back in and put in conventional batteries, if they have to go back in and re-engineer and rebuild the electrical system, not only is it going to take time, but it risks adding weight, which takes away that advantage.
Have you heard of any of the people in charge of Boeing, the bean counters from McDonnell Douglas and the others that rose up, taking responsibility for the outsourcing and its problems?
Well, there were some murmurs of that a couple of years ago and saying we won't do that again. But the kind of Jack Welchian management philosophy, which is basically treat workers like dirt in the pursuit of quote-unquote shareholder value, that's still very much in charge of the company. And, you know, it's the Asian century, and what do? They move the headquarters to Chicago, that Pacific Rim powerhouse. So all the signals have been sent wrong. The board has not held anybody to account on this. One wonders how long that can continue.
You know, you also were looking at this Reuters analysis about what this means for the company. It's too early to know the financial effects, said Boeing spokesman Charles Bickers. We're focusing on working through the process, getting to a resolution, and returning the airplanes to service. But as you said, this could be expensive for the company, bad for this region if there's a real problem. Of course, right now there's a lot of overtime.
Yeah.
What's it say for the direction the airline industry was hoping to go?
It says something very profound. We just don't know the answer yet.
But it is. You think this is? We're at a Rubicon here.
We are at the Rubicon, and we risk going into the Senate and getting stabbed by daggers. The 787 game changer was going to be this fuel efficiency and the carbon composite construction. It's not a plastic airplane. It's stronger than an aluminum airplane. But this is the direction the whole industry wants to go in. Boeing was ahead of the curve. If Boeing starts to fall backward on this or has to go back in and re-engineer and rebuild substantial portions of it, you're talking real money. The delays have already pushed back the years in that it'll take, and I may be wrong, but I think it's about 2020, before Boeing will start to turn a profit on this very expensive and very poorly developed airplane.
And right while the engineers are looking at a contract and thinking about how they're going to respond to the offer that they were given from the company.
Well, and I wrote that this was not the time to do a strike, and I'm like the in-house socialist, hardly an enemy of labor, but I got my head taken off multiple times by SPIA members who said, look, we took one for the team in the previous contract, and we're not going to do it this time. And so, and this is, you know, the nerds who are a part of No Nerds, No Birds in SPIA are not a militant union, and yet they feel very disrespected in this case. But if there is a strike, I think it bodes ill for the long-term future of this aviation cluster.
John Talton is economics columnist at Seattle Times. You were writing about Tacoma, the city of destiny that has not yet reached its destiny. You're talking about an analysis of Pierce County and its troubles and its economy. But you know, you ended by this idea here. If Pierce County could elevate its economic gain, the entire region would benefit. And as long as it lags, we all suffer against a world of competitors. Tacoma's not where it ought to be compared to other urban areas.
Right, and Pierce County. The problems go back decades. But one of the big problems we have is that the Port of Tacoma fights against Seattle for basically the same container traffic. And they won the Grand Alliance and the Hamburg-Sud line, but they won it from Seattle. When you look at the big picture, the Puget Sound ports are losing market share compared to other West Coast ports. And we've got the Panama Canal widening coming up in 2014. We've got a wider Suez, if the country doesn't blow up, that's coming. Prince Rupert in British Columbia is this container port that the government of Canada and the Canadian National Railway have built from the ground up to compete. It's the shortest sailing distance to Asia. What needs to happen is the ports of Seattle and Tacoma need to cooperate more, but Tacoma will never do this as long as it fails to have a better overall economy, because the one good thing that Pierce County and Tacoma has is that port. And so they support it. They give it political support, financial support in a way that, say, we don't. And Tacoma can underbid anybody for container traffic.
Of course, that and JBLM. Those are their big employers, Joint Base Lewis-McChord.
Right, and a big Army base brings with it certain problems as far as crime and social issues, and a big Army base and the Air Force base that is now amalgamated into it is very ripe for defense cuts.
Is there, you mentioned in this article that you wrote for the Seattle Times, you mentioned Amazon talking about expanding a warehouse building a warehouse in DuPont. Is there another industry that could emerge? And is there somebody trying to create one or bring one?
Well, there are industries that could emerge, but the old stewards have faded from the picture. The ones who, say, built the Frank Russell Company and did so much for downtown Tacoma in the 1990s. You've got really good bones down there. Now, not out in the suburbs. The suburbs are going to be increasingly this very bad sunk cost as gas prices rise and as, you know, young people want to live in vibrant cities.
Well, that should help Tacoma. It's sort of ripe for that.
Well, Tacoma has to be a vibrant city, but then you also have to have stewards with means who will push the creation of new industries and new sectors. I mean, I talk about Bill Luck with Seattle. We had Bill Luck. We had Bill Boeing, Bill Gates. And that's just been the gift that keeps on giving. We have a steward in Paul Allen who redeveloped South Lake Union. Jeff Bezos wants to be here, put a headquarters there. We have the University of Washington, a major public research university until we kill it by defunding. And all of these things attract world talent. They attract young people, vibrancy. We have a vibrant, wonderful downtown. Pierce County needs that because Pierce County is not just 10,000 people sitting in this wonderful rural idol. And I got a tremendous amount of favorable email from Tacoma and Pierce County, except for Cindy, whose subject line was pompous fool. And I resemble that remark. It's almost as good as Talton, you're an idiot, Y-O-U-R, an idiot.
What would, if there was to be cooperation between the two ports, that talks about, you have to expand the pie. So what's the possibility of cooperation that brings us either more container traffic or different kinds of port traffic?
Well, I think we need...
And of course, if you knew the answer, you'd be working for the port.
Well, or I'd start my own port. Who knows? there's no easy answer, but I think that it's closer cooperation to grow the pie, to go after additional container traffic that is, say, now going to Oakland or to L.A. Long Beach that could go here to protect the existing pie to keep it from going to Prince Rupert, to get different kinds of additional traffic, to follow on the Seattle vision of a very green port. And I know the Teamsters have their issues with this, which have some legitimacy too. But a green port in the future is going to be very advantageous. But the Port of Tacoma will do very little to even talk to Seattle now because the fear is that it'll be another one of these things that is subsumed into the Seattle Borg, and then Tacoma loses its last really good high-value industry.
Yeah, tell that to the Russell folks who are now commuting up here from Tacoma, right?
Or have moved up here.
Yeah, or moved, yeah. Tell me something. You're not thrilled with the new choice of the new head of the SEC?
Mary Jo White.
Mary Jo White?
No.
Former prosecutor?
Putting the fox in charge of the hen house.
She brought down John Gotti.
Yeah, well, she also went to work defending Ken Lewis at Bank of America and made a lot of money doing it. When FDR set up the SEC in the 30s, after all the frauds of the 1920s that helped bring on the Depression, he put in charge of it Joseph P. Kennedy, who was a notorious Wall Street shark who made money in the stock market in the 20s. He got out of it famously when he started getting stock tips from his shoeshine boys. And people were shocked that FDR did this. And FDR said, to catch a thief, set a thief. And Joseph P. Kennedy set up a Securities and Exchange Commission that made our markets transparent and honest. And when he was through and he left, he said he could never invest in stocks again because the only way he knew how to do it would break all of the laws that he put in place and all the rules he put in place. With Mary Jo White, you have a very different creature. And I don't see anything that the SEC is going to do under her. But we'll give her the benefit of the doubt. Gretchen Morgenson in the New York Times had a very good starting point, and that is to stop these settlements where these companies pay a wrist slap fine and do not admit guilt. Make them admit guilt. But then we need to have some real hard time in a supermax with a cellmate called Big Nate for some of these CEOs, like I could mention Angelo Mozillo at Countrywide, and there's some guy who used to run WAMU. Until those things happen, we are not going to have honest markets. We need to look at the deep pools. We need to look at the flash trading. All the way average investors are basically being defrauded and the markets are being made unstable. And here's the thing. This is bad for capitalism. This is bad for free markets. I can't imagine how anybody would defend the status quo.
And yet they keep doing it.
They do.
John Talton writes about economics at theroguecolumnist.com and for the Seattle Times as economic columnist. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you again. And by the way, just real quick to end, we were talking about Seattle today and the objects of Seattle. Here's a very Seattle sound, the sound of wool garments being produced at Filson in the Soto neighborhood. Weekday listener Jack recorded that sound, saying that within the next 2 years, Filson would be back to making 100% American-made products. Very rare, as we were discussing.
Police in Alabama are in a standoff with a gunman who shot and killed a bus driver and took a 6-year-old boy hostage. An update in the news in a moment. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.